Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today's day is August 27th, 2002. Today's session is Who, When, Where, and Why It Matters in the Middle East, Implications of History and Geography by Middle East Peace, presented by Anne Hafton, number HAA 2002-03. Let's listen in.
Who, what, and where, who, when, and where in the Middle East, and why it matters. And Tate Ministry, you can start the tape. My name is Anne Hafton. I'm Director for Middle East Networking for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Division for Global Mission. A little preface, I'm newly hired to work with congregations, in particular around advocacy efforts, prayer, and grassroots organizing on Middle East issues. I'm going to put another little blue handout within sight of you here. If you have folks in your congregation or if you are interested in continuing to be involved in these issues, please pick one of these up because this tells you how to get onto my email listserv and how to reach me by email so that I can help you and your congregation on organizing and education and prayer issues around the Middle East. This will be right here. This evening's session is called Who, What, Who, Where, and When, and Why It Matters. These are all questions that always concern discussions of the Middle East. Just a coffee break this morning, someone who shall remain nameless asked me to cite for him the Balfour Declaration by heart. and so this history, the geography, the timeline, and inevitably the maps have a lot to do with the way we interpret issues and concerns in the Middle East today. Which one do you need?
Hold tonight.
Just share with others, because everybody didn't get everything. It's kind of a share deal. Can you send that back around? Yeah, lots of handouts tonight, so don't be worried if you didn't have one. Lots of them are for sharing. Here. You can talk. So I thought maybe we could answer some of these questions on the history, the people, the land, the borders, and get a little sense of that for you to put it in place. Last night I started right out with the most current issues around the peace process, and I did that deliberately because this area we're in tonight is an area that it's easy to get bogged down in, and we'll try not to. We'll try to keep it buoyant, but if we'd started here, we probably never would have gotten to Oslo or the Camp David Accords. So tonight we can talk a little bit about how things got to be the way they are in the Middle East now. There's one gross error on this blue timeline sheet I gave you, and this is a bit dated. This is something I developed a long time ago and only unearthed when I moved to Texas 3 weeks ago. Honestly, I could not find it for several years. It was in a box of things that went through a flood at my house in Chicago. And I couldn't find it, but there it was just as I was getting ready to come here. So this ends in 1990, but the most important flaw is at the very beginning, where it says 135 BC, Jewish revolt put down by Romans, Jews deported from Palestine. That is so wrong. It's supposed to be 135 AD. So just draw a little arrow and put that whole sector down below the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And then maybe for starters we can just walk through a little of this timeline and help you understand how there came to be Jews, Muslims, and Christians all living in the land of Palestine that became the land of Israel and became the occupied territories that we sometimes call Palestine today. The history of the Jewish people or the Israelites is familiar to all of you who've ever been to Sunday school and all the way up to, but possibly not including, the destruction of Jerusalem, the leveling of the temple, the city essentially bulldozed to the extent they could do that in Roman times, and the dispersion of the Jews to points west, north, and east. This is how there came to be Jews in Spain. This is how there came to be Jews in Rome in Paul's day and another time, in later times. And the whole story of the Jewish diaspora is a fascinating one. There's a wonderful museum in Tel Aviv, the Museum of the Diaspora, where you can walk through displays that show the manifestations of the Jewish people, their culture, their religion, their observance, and their life together in places as remote as Spain, of course, Poland, Russia, Siberia, and all the way to Argentina, and of course the United States. The most significant movement of Jews back to the land of Israel, which is a little bit of a loaded expression, let me amend myself, back to what was then Palestine, came in the late 19th century. If you've seen Fiddler on the Roof or read novels about that period in Russia, Poland, the Ukraine, Belarus, you know that Jews in these parts of Central Europe were subject to persecution. The Cossacks and all those persons in power who resented the rising middle class and the use of trading among the Jews, the mercantile culture of the Jews, incited these persecutions that were called pogroms. Jews in these parts of the world were not allowed to own agricultural land or farm, so they became moneylenders, jewelers, middlemen, and the merchant class. About that same time, or a little later, there began to flourish in some of those parts of the world, and particularly in Germany and Austria, what was called the Zionist movement. And it manifested in a number of different ways, and I know some people who took part in it and have heard their stories, and it's very interesting. But it was one of those times in history on our planet when something caught fire, and particularly young people, very young, young people as young as 14, 15, and 16 left their homes and migrated to Palestine to be a part of this movement that was creating a Jewish homeland or a place for Jews to be safe. Jews were not safe in Russia, Germany, Poland, these other places. They were under attack regularly, and in cycles. Every few years, there would be another round of pogroms. And some of these young people had a big vision, and man, they were idealistic. They wanted to farm the land, something their fathers and grandfathers and grandparents had never been able to do. They wanted a landed existence. They had a very idealistic view of farming. They wanted to bring forth food and sustain themselves and not be dependent on their place in society as a middle rank and vulnerable. They wanted to make themselves strong and self-sufficient and able to defend themselves. And they were very young people. One of my very, very best women friends in the world is a woman named Dina Carmon, who came from Germany at 16 in 1933. And she stayed in a camp until there was land acquired by the Jewish National Fund, which was also very busy creating places for these youth camps and settlements, the wrong word to use, kibbutz, cooperative farms, to form themselves in the land of Palestine, which was, of course, occupied by Palestinians. And she, aside, you know, her story is a sad one in that her family came along, followed her a couple of years later, her brother, sister, two brothers and a sister, and her parents and her grandparents all came to Palestine. But the life was hard there in the camps while they waited for land to be available, and it didn't get much easier once they got land and moved to their farm. But it was too hard on the parents and the grandparents. They decided frontier life was not for them. They returned to Germany in 1938. Of course, they did not survive the Holocaust. Her brother immigrated to Canada, and her sister and her other brother still live in Israel. So she's just like lots of other people. So while this was happening, there's a bunch of dates I've kind of skipped over, but the Zionist Congress was held that decided unilaterally that Palestine would be the home for the Jews. And at the same time, in a very duplicitous way, Britain, which governed much of what was then called Arabia, including Egypt, Palestine, and the lands of that would become Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, made a deal with the Arab groups there that they would have independence if they helped Britain fight the Turks in World War I. I'm sure you've seen this all play out in Lawrence of Arabia. We watched it just the other night. The Arab communities were not unified into nation states. They followed various sheikhs and muftis. The Palestinians in particular were assigned the mufti of Jerusalem to be their leader. Others had sheikhs and leaders that became subsequently the leaders of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. Then in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was approved in the British Parliament. This was a an action that took place at the same time that the British were assuring the Arabs of independence throughout Arabia. They also, and you want to say, who gives them the authority? But because of the way that that area, the Ottoman Empire, had been divided up after World War I, Britain and France governed the different areas of Arabia. Britain governed Egypt, Palestine, France governed Lebanon, Syria, and so forth. So by the way things were managed in those days, the Western powers, Britain was in charge. And they could decide. So they ruled that a homeland for the Jewish people would be established in Palestine. And I promised someone the exact language of that declaration, because it does include some meager compensation or consideration for the Palestinians. Here's the Balfour Declaration's promise. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. All right. in the long run, as this played out over the next years, as the horrors of the Holocaust became known to the world, and as the hundreds of thousands of refugees, the survivors of the Holocaust, fled Germany looking for some place to go, Palestine, for many, was a no-brainer. That was a place where they felt that they could go and be safe. So at a certain point, now, well, just this evening we were singing the music from the movie Exodus, the influx of Jews became so high in Palestine that the indigenous people here that were supposed to be considered, there should be no prejudice to their civil and religious rights. Well, that may be the way it was laid out in the Balfour Declaration, but on the ground, the existing Arab, or we now call them Palestinian population, was feeling a very tight pinch as more and more and more Jews from Europe were flooding into Palestine. So there began a period of violence in the 1920s, and now there became another period of violence in the 40s, as Israel kind of ginned up their machine to become a state recognized by the UN, and particularly by the United States. So there are more details on this sheet than I can go through. Well, we can come back to them if you want to. But
how many Palestinians lived there?
How many Palestinians lived there then?
That were Jewish.
I don't have that figure in my head. But I know that at the time that the 1947 presentation of a division was suggested, and that's what I'm just getting up to, 1948, the proclamation of the State of Israel. Just before that, the UN had proposed a division, which there was no Palestinian leadership, so the Arabs of the region, they included the Mufti of Jerusalem and some other leaders, they turned it down. The Jewish population was one-third of the total inhabitants, and that was in 1947. But the land that this deal would have awarded them was 52% of the territory. So for the Arab leadership, they just saw that as, well, that's completely unacceptable. There aren't enough of them to warrant giving them 52% of the land. And that is the source of their original declining of the deal, which always comes up in discussion.
What source are you quoting for the population percentage statistics? Like in 1897, you say less than 10%. I mean, where are these numbers coming from?
Well, I don't remember, because I put this timeline together a long time ago. But I'm sure I worked on it at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have published it if I wasn't pretty confident of it. Mm-hmm. This number, that which is new to me, this 52% of the territory, comes from a speech by Robert Keeley, who was the former ambassador to Greece. I'm very impressed with a speech that he gave this summer, and anyone who wants can look at a copy of it.
I've seen those numbers before. Those are pretty widely accepted numbers.
Yeah, I think so. But honestly, like I said, I apologize at the outset, because this little timeline was something I made up a long time ago, and I don't mean made up, but I mean constructed. yeah, that's it, I made it up. So that kind of brings us up to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and the war then that created a great dispersal of populations, an influx, a continuing influx of Jews, a big dispersal of Palestinians by both through fleeing for their lives and also through forced evictions. and the divided nation that existed between 1948 and 1967. Before 1967, the city of Jerusalem and the old city, in particular, the walled city, was divided. This is an area of big meaning, more than symbol, more than hometown. Jerusalem has enormous meaning. Imagine what it means to us as Christians that Jerusalem is the place where Jesus was crucified and resurrected. It's a lot. It's easily that much to Jews and very, very much to Muslims. And for Jews, the fact that the old city, the walled city, was on the Jordanian side after the 1948 war, that was a sadness for them, something they mourned. But following the 1967 war, maybe you saw the famous photograph from Life magazine of the Israeli soldiers, you know, all sweaty and dirty, and there they are at the Western Wall, and there's what we sometimes call the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall, and they're there with their troops. They've taken it, you know, by God. And, you know, whoa, I remember that. And it was one of the great photojournalist, you know, depictions of all time. And it was something to recover that place, that fragment of the temple that the Jews had not had access to for a long, long time. That kind of is a little aside, that kind of leads to a little myth. I mean, the Israelis will often allude to the fact that they didn't have access to the wall for hundreds of years. But actually, that's not really the case. Prior to World War I, Jews freely moved around the city and coexisted with Muslims and Christians. They each had their own little zone or quarter, as they call it. They governed themselves. They kept to their own quarters, but they moved freely to the wall. It wasn't like Jews were kept away from the Western Wall until 1948. And then there was this period when Jordan ruled. Jordan held the old city. And there was barbed wire all over the place. You can go to a museum that's just about the division of Jerusalem. And then in 1967, it's all recovered. It comes over to the Israeli side, along with this big chunk of territory called the West Bank. I talked a lot about that last night. If you're able to refer to some of these maps, you can see the way Israel has administered this territory. This fellow that I've been quoting, Kinney, he said something interesting about how we shouldn't refer to the West Bank as captured, which the Israelis sometimes do, or occupied. No, he said they are occupied, but they are not captured because in war, when you capture something, you keep it. Instead, they are occupied, and Israel administers them. But they are also not disputed, because in international law and our understanding of UN resolutions, these territories remain occupied. They are not part of Israel, nor are they under dispute. They just haven't been resolved yet. So language becomes important here. I want to get to where and the maps in a minute, but maybe I'll take a minute and talk about the who. A little bit about who are these people. The folks that lived in Palestine prior to the big incursion of Jews after the pogroms were an assortment of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. who lived in a very, almost a feudal setting up until the early 1900s. The walled city of Jerusalem, for example, closed the gates at night. There were some European Jews, one in particular, I can't remember his name, who came and built a windmill there. I mean, they created some neighborhoods outside the city walls, but it was really slow to develop as a world capital. Instead, it was a very symbolic and kind of like the navel of the universe for a lot of people. So when they talked about going to Jerusalem, they went there for spiritual and for political reasons, but not too much for commerce or, you know, the kind of global economics that we think of today. There was a Christian community both in Jerusalem and in the surrounding towns of Bethlehem, Beit Jala, and Beit Zahur. They were primarily Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, and a little bit later in the 20th century, Syrian Orthodox. The Lutherans were quite late to come to the area, and I don't think they really came as a missionary group, but as a education, it was an education outreach and a health services outreach. And I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow night. But the Anglicans came with a strong education ministry. And throughout Jerusalem and the West Bank, the Christians are known as the educators and the educated ones. Sometimes this is a problem. As if you see the book I recommended last night, Blood Brothers, or no, I'm sorry, For the Body and the Blood, you see how in some cases, in some communities, there's a little bit of stratification with the Christians, the better educated, the middle class, sometimes the educated abroad, and the more well off, the more like the middle class. And that plays it, that becomes a problem today when the communities really need to work together, but the Muslim and Christian communities are sometimes divided, not by religious or doctrinal divisions, but by a class system that's been going on there for a couple of hundred years. The Jews in Israel, prior to the influx of European Jews, were a very old and faithful, but a small community. They had their own sector in the old city, and they were there, but they weren't much of a force. Really, it was a Muslim community ruled by the Mufti in Jerusalem. The outlying Galilee, the area that's now the West Bank, and the coastal plain were all occupied by Palestinian villages, subsistence farmers, mostly folks living in small villages and kind of eking out a life out of what they could farm there. There were some wealthy farmers who had big olive groves, big orange groves. The Jaffa orange was famous long before the State of Israel as one of the most delicious oranges in the world. It comes from Gaza, renamed for marketing purposes, the Jaffa orange. But much of the land was owned by absentee landlords. They were sometimes Turks, sometimes Lebanese, sometimes people from Istanbul, and they owned a lot of the real estate in Palestine, what became the British Mandate of Palestine. The region was also very treeless, and you often hear people from the Zionist movement talk about how they came to Israel and planted trees. There had been trees there before, but in building the railroads that the Turks needed to operate their economic system from Cairo to Istanbul and across the region, they had taken a lot of the trees down to build those railroads. So there was a lot of barren area that didn't look fruitful to, wouldn't look fruitful to us by the way we understand what a healthy, good-looking farm looks like. But for grazing purposes and for pastoral culture and of subsistence farmers, it was heavily populated and people were living the way they had been living for a long time. So sometimes you hear this myth about a land without people for people without land. This didn't come out of nowhere. This was a motto or a slogan that was generated by the financial supporters of the Zionist movement and perpetuated by journalists. So there were people living there, lots of people. And the easy way to know it is because if there weren't so many people living there, why would there be so many refugees? I hadn't put that together, but this author, this Kenny, Ambassador Kenny, put that together very neatly for me. If there really weren't any people there, there wouldn't be the number of refugees that there were after 1948 and again after 1967. There were plenty of people there, and some of them are families that I've come in contact with. They were fearful. There had been a lot of violence between 1920 and 1948. And so when the war began to emerge between the folks who were, they weren't Israelis yet, but they were preparing to create the State of Israel, and the forces of the Arab world from mostly from Syria and Egypt and what would become Jordan, they were scared. There had already been some violence. There had been some bad massacres among the some contingents of the what would become the Israeli army. There were also some wild cards among the Israeli political groups. The group Menachem Begin was involved with, who planted bombs around in parts of Jerusalem where British and Arab leaders were meeting. And there was violence from the other side too. The folks that I know from the kibbutz I've spent a lot of time in, that kibbutz was started in 1937. And they were, 10 years before statehood, they were farming in a region on the plain of Philistia. Their land had been acquired for them by the Jewish National Fund, and they were organized by the kibbutz movement to which they were part. They came from Canada, the U.S., Germany, and Poland. And they were kind of clumped together, a little bit like at Holden. You can't really pick who's going to be at Holden when you are. They couldn't choose. They were just put together by the movement and planted out there to farm. The land they farmed had previously had 5 Arab villages on the hills and in the low parts of the acreage that became theirs. They bought it, or the Jewish National Fund bought it for them from an absentee landlord. And some of you heard me say this Saturday night. Those Arab villages who had a friendly relationship with the Jewish farmers, as a matter of fact, hired them to help with their plowing. They had to evacuate and move all down into a central one town that was about 4 miles away, because the land now belonged to the Jews. So you can see how this, these are all people that are trying to do something, but it's not working because there's a element of injustice and manipulation at work, and you might have a law on your side, but is it right? The Palestinians who lived in the community around my farm had no meaningful health care, from what my elder friends tell me. And their doctor served that whole Palestinian community on a you know, gratis basis, and was beloved by them. I don't know any really how social services were administered before 1937, but it seems that there weren't any. It was a feudal kind of a third world, you know, existence. And so you can say, well, it was a good thing the Israelis came, the Jews came, and they set up these health clinics, and now the kids don't have bugs in their eyes. Okay, but now the people don't have any land to farm, so it's a problem. It created a problem. Those are a few examples of the kinds of people who were in the land, the kinds of, and I think I told you a little about the kinds of people who came to the land, such as my friend Dina, who came as a young girl, and lots of others of friends who came as idealists, and they really believed that. Dina's husband Israel believes and will say to us as recently as last February, there has to be a safe place for the Jews to live. We simply are not safe in any place, like where he grew up in Montreal. And Montreal had a flourishing Jewish community. But there was always anti-Semitism. There was a political oppression, he felt. There was a presence of anti-Semitism in the community, such that as a young man in his 20s, he said, I will not live in a culture of anti-Semitism. I'm going to where Jews can be safe. And I'm going to take part in building a safe home for Jews. So he went to this same farm where I worked in 1937. And as an idealist, you know. There are lots of other, you know, profiles of people, but those are a few of the kinds of people that were all coming in and all trying to maintain some power and some influence, economic and political, in the same little patch of land. Now, I said I would talk a bit about maps, because, this is one of those times when maps are just really important, and they have a powerful political message. This is the map you get when you fly into Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, and your Holy Land tour guide picks you up, and the Israeli Ministry of Tourism gives you this map. You're going to go as a Holy Land tourist to Bethlehem, to Nazareth, up into Galilee. And you can't see this, but I'm going to hold it up anyway. Because this map that is distributed through the Israeli Ministry of Tourism at the airport shows the state of Israel right here. The Jordan River, the Dead Sea, the Mediterranean, and there, you would have no way of knowing from looking at this map that there is a big chunk of territory here that is occupied, that there is a border at all. You wouldn't know this, and they don't really want you to know it. They don't want you thinking about it because you're a tourist. They want you to just go, move around, get on the bus, and go where they take you. Don't ask any questions. It's not evil-spirited, it's just good tourism economics. But you can, as you travel through the country as a tourist, you're looking at this map and you don't know whether you're in Israel or not, because there's no indication that the occupied territories exist here.
But for them, it's all Israel, no matter what, right?
For some of them. Not for others. Not for my friends. My friends won't go into the... My friends on this farm, they're leftists. They won't go into the occupied territories. They won't go anywhere near them because they don't believe in it.
They don't believe that it should be that way.
They don't believe that it should be part of... that Israel should even occupy there. But
why is it called occupied rather than captured?
Because if it were captured, according to this guy, if it were, it's all semantics, but if it were captured, you can make it your own. And because of the UN resolutions, Israel cannot make it their own. So they can only administer it. Because they're not about to let it go soon.
So your friends that are the leftists that don't agree with it, what would they have done with it?
Give it back.
Give it back.
But I gotta say, they are not the man on the street. There are plenty of folks in Israel who feel that way, but they're all part of the most left-wing parties, and they're pretty defeated by even the Labor Party, which is used to be the left of center, isn't really that progressive in terms of, I mean, every Labor Party administration has held on to the West Bank and built settlements. Yes, sir.
Could you comment on the impact that the death of Yitzhak Rabin had on modern current politics? I know it's not on your timeline, but
yeah,
it's like an important historical moment.
Yeah, it's a big historical moment. What year was Rabin assassinated? 1999?
95.
Yeah.
94, 95.
93, the Oslo Accords were signed. Might have been 95. Well, Yitzhak Rabin is an interesting character. He was a military leader and highly regarded as an effective military leader. And among political leaders, different political leaders have something to offer, and it might be charm, or it might be smarts, or it might be influence. But when you elect a military leader as your political leader, which Israel consistently does, that plays in. Yitzhak Rabin was a general who had been an officer in the military from 67 and forward. He was very highly regarded as a very effective military leader. Even among folks who didn't much appreciate his politics, they saw him as a valuable military leader. When he was elected, and David Horowitz talks about this some in the book that I recommended, that's in the bookstore, A Little Too Close to God. He was a huge fan of Rabin, and he basically went into despair when Rabin was killed. Rabin is one of those guys who experienced a transformation. In the earlier Intifada that lasted from 87 until about 1991, he was the guy, he was the enforcer. And he wasn't a nice guy at all. He wasn't somebody you wanted to spend time with. He was the guy who told the troops about these boys throwing rocks, break their arms. And about any Palestinian that put up resistance. And that earlier intifada was relatively nonviolent compared to what we have now. There was stone throwing, there were some Molotov cocktails, and he was very outspoken, and he said it publicly so everyone would know, break their bones. That was his slogan. And you can read the accounts from the Israeli troops, the boys, and how they felt about having to take an 11-year-old boy and break his arm. He was not a beloved guy, but it was a very, he put down that intifada with brute force. And then in his presidency, he was transformed. The kind of thinking that changed Sadat's mind and Begin's, whether he started thinking about his grandchildren. But he saw an opportunity with Oslo, and someone got to him and persuaded him to bring the Oslo Accords into being with Arafat. And you saw his reluctance to shake Arafat's hand. I mean, he had fought this guy his whole career. So we'll never know what would have happened if he had lived. He was killed by an Israeli extremist, somebody who saw him because of his work for peace, saw him as putting Israel and greater Israel in jeopardy. And that there's a very sad tendency in some quarters in Israel to revere that assassin. He's in jail. Israel does not have capital punishment since they killed Eichmann. And they, there are some radicals who just revere him as a saint. They almost, they just exalt him. And he's an assassin. So a lot of people like David Horowitz and others feel that the tide turned at that point. There was another election. Everyone was afraid. People were nervous. There was backlash, and they elected to the far right. And then it's been that way ever since. Does that help?
Yeah.
It's a strange thing to mourn Rabin. You know, my friends on the kibbutz, I mean, they had no time for Rabin. They kidded about him because he was such a brutal guy. And yet, I think the reason maybe people came to love him so much is that he had the power to change, or he made himself open to change. And his widow has continued, you know, she's now allied with the left, and to be a voice really constantly niggling the Israeli government to work for peace when they don't really want to. But he made a big step, and he maybe could have done more to carry it out. We'll never know, I guess. Well, I'll just return to this maps thing for a minute, and then I'll let you ask questions. So this is the kind of map you get when you get into the state. Just for the fun of it, this is another map that fell out of my files when I was moving. This is a map of all the kibbutzim in Israel, and some in the West Bank as well. I had to look real hard. As a matter of fact, the first time I looked at this, I did not see the borders that they call the green line that separates the pre-1967 border from the occupied West Bank. But when I got it under some better light and took my glasses off, I could see that actually there was a really tiny little line that does indicate the West Bank on this map. This is a map for folks who want to go and work on a kibbutz and volunteer, and it, for all practical purposes, doesn't differentiate between Israel and the West Bank, which surprises me because most of the kibbutz movements are quite left-leaning, and I thought that it would be different. I was surprised by that one. The maps you hold in your hands, the smaller one was one I copied from the New Yorker, which just shows you the lay of the land. Let me kind of look over someone's shoulder here. this one.
Okay. Go for it.
Yeah, this one shows you how Israel and the West Bank are situated in relation to Lebanon, Syria, and I just thought it was a really well done map of the region. And for that purpose, I made some copies. You can see the West Bank always kind of shaped like a lima bean here, with Jerusalem in that little crotch there, and always contested. And down here, the forlorn little Gaza Strip with the highest population ratio, this side of Hong Kong. There's only one place more densely populated than the Gaza Strip, and that's the city of Hong Kong.
And Hong Kong's packed.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody knows that information.
Nobody knows that's true?
Nobody knows that that's true. I mean, it's kind of generally aware of it.
And Hong Kong actually has sewers, which helps a lot.
Why is it that the Gaza Strip is so heavily populated?
Because at the time of the 1948 war, first people fled. They fled from the desert areas, it would be west, into Gaza, and from the whole coastal plain, from Tel Aviv south, even from Haifa, people fled down into Gaza, which they knew to be administered by Egypt. And they thought they'd get behind, they wanted to get behind the advancing Arab troops. So that was one group, those who fled. But all along the coastal plain, there also were cities such as Lod and Ramla and others. Lod is where Ben Gurion Airport is now. It was once an Arab city. And the city of Ramla and others, where the people were forced to evacuate. I mean, house to house with, you know, military force and guns, just sending people out, grab what you can and go. Many of them went to Gaza because it was the closest place to run to, and they didn't have much to carry with them. They couldn't really leave by sea. Some did go to the West Bank, but that was a tougher trip through a war zone. So the Gaza Strip, which is a small area, just was jammed with refugees, and continues to be. There are two main municipalities in Gaza. One is Gaza City, the other is Rafah. The Israelis call it Rafah, the Arabs call it Rafia. And folks who lived in those cities, their homes are pretty much intact. But all these other people that came in, hundreds of thousands of them were refugees. And yet, somehow, if you look at this map, you'll see that somehow Israel is able to put some settlements in Gaza, despite how crowded it is. There are Israeli settlements in Gaza, and I, for the life of me, don't know who would want to go and live there unless they have to make a political point. Because Gaza is a place where you are really not wanted if you're an Israeli. They are fortresses surrounded by barbed wire. But life for the people in Gaza has become quite bad since the Oslo agreements. For example, fishing rights. Some of these stories I just got from the Lutheran magazine, by the way. Look at the last six or seven issues of the Lutheran magazine. Almost every other issue has a good story about some folks in the Middle East, Lutherans or others. But, for example, along the coast of Gaza, where many people made their livelihood for generations by fishing, now the Israelis have put security zones out, a certain ways out into the water, so they can fish. The indigenous Gaza people can fish right close to shore, but obviously there aren't any fish there. And then the areas.
Why do they do that?
Because they were Well, they say they do it because they're afraid terrorists will come in. They'll be supplied. The terrorists in Gaza will be supplied by sea. And that's worth arguing about. I mean, it's likely, possible. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the population there can't support themselves. Plus, most of their agriculture has been disrupted by can you go to the orchard and pick olives, or will they shoot you? It's mm-hmm. never clear.
Gaza is just a big prison.
Yeah, Gaza is a big prison.
And so how do they support themselves now?
International aid? They're very poor. It's very, very rough in Gaza. And you can't leave. You can't get, for the most part, you can't get in and out of Gaza. Much of the agriculture has been dug up. Orange groves and olive groves.
Gaza oranges.
Yeah. And but that's the extreme. Really, the part that's important to think about is that during the period of the Oslo Agreement, even, there were folks trying to you know, live out this peace agreement, and yet, for example, farmers in Gaza who had produce, where can they sell it? In Israel, obviously, that's the only place really for them to sell their produce. The other side is the Sinai Desert. It's a long way to Egypt. Their market is in Israel or abroad. Well, with the regular closures that Israel was imposing throughout the period after Oslo, and it's hard. I would like to be able to see it as somehow meaningful, but it's hard not to see these kinds of manipulations in their worst construction. There, for example, here's a farmer who has a crop and has gotten it to market, has gotten it to Gaza Harbor port, and is ready to send it to Europe or whoever will take it. But then the Israelis won't let it go. Or he wants to ship it to Israel to sell to the Israeli market. Israel won't let it in. And this happened in the same way that the housing restrictions happened, by using a sequence of administrative rules that are just what I want. They're just random. And they're meant to cripple the economy, but the terrible outcome is that they destroy families and farmers. I mean, you know that. Sure, yeah, they achieved a slowdown in the Gazan economy, but here are families who their whole crop is gone, and now who can they turn to for supplementary help? Hamas. They're there with their social services and ready to help them out. So it,
I don't know, it just
feeds in.
Pretty fun.
Yeah. Okay, we got like 5 minutes. I guess if you have questions about the maps or the timelines, just pitch them out. Uh-huh.
I have sort of questions about who funds Israel and why do they continue to support them? So, like, does the United States fund Israel to do this sort of thing? And why? Why?
Yes, the United States funds Israel. But sometimes the way the funding moves is a little bit of sleight of hand. For example, does the U.S. Fund the building of settlements in the West Bank? Not directly, but because they underwrite almost the entire Israeli military expenditure, they can just move all those dollars over to building settlements and providing government subsidies for people to move to the West Bank. Under some construction I don't understand to this day, since Oslo, 29 highways for use by Israelis only were built through the West Bank and the West Bank cities at the cost of $3 billion to American taxpayers. And I don't get that one yet. I want to research that a little bit more. Why is an interesting question. I don't think we have a lot of sentimental attachment. This is my opinion. I'm just going to say, I don't think we have a lot of guilt about the Holocaust anymore. I don't think we have a lot of sentimental attachment to Israel. We have a strategic interest in that region. Israel is our proxy. There are our military support and economic support for the state of Israel is a strategic one. A lot of Americans don't like what they're doing now. Mm-hmm. That won't change policy because it's all about Israel and their army and air force, which is second to none, being our proxy for that whole oil rich region. That's my opinion.
I'm curious about the other Arab countries that are sitting by so silently. I mean, they invited the Palestinians to come to the Gaza Strip and then they've left.
Is that
kind of essentially true?
Yeah.
Where are they in this? I mean, you know, they don't want to accept the Palestinians either.
No, they don't. And Jordan accepted them for quite a while until they became too disruptive and King Hussein threw them out, and then they went to Lebanon. And maybe you remember the Lebanon War of the 80s. In my opinion, the Arab leaders see the Palestinians as a problem child. They don't help the statehood for the Palestinians doesn't really help any of the Arab states in any way, from their perspective, I think. But the issue of the refugees is an important one, and it's cultural, and it goes to another kind of strategy. If you have a refugee camp full of refugees and you take care of it, you disperse them, you build them homes, you give them new land, you incorporate them into your world, be it Jordan or Egypt or whatever, well, then they don't continue to be a problem for the world and for Israel and for the United States. And so there's a certain ethos at work in those Arab states that they want to be able to hold up the Palestinians and say, look what you've done to these people. And that I hope that's a fair representation. I'm open to somebody else's interpretation. But I feel that they... Jordan administered them until 1967. And then it fell to Israel to administer them under the UN.
So how come we... then let them go out to other countries?
I'm sorry.
Were they ever able to, like the Gaza Strip, were they ever able to go to other countries? Why not?
Well, some do. Some emigrate.
Wouldn't Israel let them go if Egypt said we'll take them? No.
Yeah, but that's like saying, we could say to the Mexicans in Texas, well, you can all just go back to Mexico.
Or maybe we should.
No, or something like that. I mean,
lucky we didn't have a UN then, or we wouldn't have Texas.
Yeah, precisely. or better yet, for the Mexicans to say to the Texans, you can all go back to Kentucky or England or wherever you came from. That's a much better analysis. They're pawns. Who said it? They're pawns.
And they're food.
Now four generations or more. And the younger the people, the less regard they have for their elders. So while three generations ago the grandfather was revered and obeyed, and maybe he said stay put, they stay put. And then, the generation of my generation or older, they were maybe wanted to move, wanted to build a new house, at least do something to improve themselves. They were obeyed as the father. But now what they're sociologists are finding is that the 14-year-olds presently in the West Bank and Gaza don't care what their father says. They're gonna take part in this insurrection.
I have a feeling that the Arab states all hate Israel, and the easy way for them to do it is to fund the Palestinians and let them do their dirty work.
That's a fair analysis.
Is there some truth to some of the Arab states laying claim to some land that could be Palestinian land? I've heard that before. That Jordan would lay claim to some of the West Bank.
Yeah, there could be.
Gaza would be Egypt.
Syria could claim the Golan Heights, and there are some parts of the West Bank that, well, Egypt gave up the entire claim to Gaza when Israel gave up the Sinai. So, but most of them are on the record saying, we don't care. We don't care about that anymore. Just settle this.
Syria too?
Well, Syria has a struggle with Israel because the Golan is another occupied area, but it's not in the West Bank. I think I have to close because it is 7:15. So bring your questions to me individually. Turn in anything with a card back, please turn it in. And please pick up a blue sheet and join by...
Could I just make one comment on the refugee situation?
Sure.
It's not quite as clear-cut, at least when I was in Amman, the Franciscan sisters there were telling significant stories about the number of Palestinian refugees in Jordan and their significant health problems and the burden upon Jordan social services resulting from.
It was a big problem for Jordan.
Big what?
It was a big problem for Jordan to administer that. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're saying?
And Jordan did not feel, of course, that they had a responsibility to take on huge numbers of additional Palestinian refugees,
right.
But there were lots of them there.
Well, and they did accept quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
So there are more Palestinians in Jordan than there are Jordanians.
Okay.
Do you think that there's any, you know, hope at all that if the leftist people ever got their way through, that this would all be given back to the Palestinians, that they would actually be able to live side by side without continued harassment?
That's another question.
I pray for that. I really do. I don't know if I... Is it a likelihood?
It
seems like a no-brainer, but...
I just wonder how well they would be able to administer themselves amongst all of this now.
I think they might administer themselves pretty well if Israel got out of the way.
Yeah.
But Israel has never withdrawn the way they promised to in Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do two things. You can't, you know, cook on two burners at one time. And there was also corruption and problems in the Palestinian leadership. But give them another chance.
Thank you again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Look. The DGM will collect and transfer to the
church.
GSCJ, yeah. If you write to... did I give you my card before?
Yeah, you did.
Send me an email and I'll forward you to the right person.
Is it Said Al-Ghul?
It's Said Al-Ghul.
No, Said. He's preaching at the church.
Yeah, and if you send him the money, he'll get it right where it belongs.
Okay. He'd maybe be a good person to talk sabbatical. Chris and I were talking this morning about if we were to go as a family to Jerusalem, where would be a good place to try to stay for a month? Do you know?
I mean, you could stay at Tantur on the road to Bethlehem, where some friends of mine have stayed.
It's there.
But maybe the best person, people to ask would be the missionaries. Then.
Yeah.
Because they know they're on the ground.
And do you have a way to reach them? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I can just email you for that.
You just ask me, I can send you that.
Okay, I'll email you for that.
Because that is not on the ELC webpage. They keep missionary info, you know.
Not
for distribution.
Okay.
But
yeah, and if it's more comfortable for you just to do it on my behalf, and then they can email me, if, you know.
Yeah, or if you just email me, I'll forward respond.
It to them. Okay.
Or forward it. Yeah.
What are their names?
Michael and Susan Thomas.
They've been in the Northwest, haven't they?
They were here at Holden a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, they were. I think I met them a couple of years ago.
They're wondering, frankly, what to do, where to put their kids in school right now. Mm. So, how about that, Matt? Thank you, Tara. So, because that's always a problem for missionaries.
Yeah.
And right now, the school where their kids have been enrolled, there's some kind of problem with it.
Oh.
So, they're struggling as a family.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I missed it last night.
I thought
night.
I kind of dribbled out here just now talking to you, but that's because I'm picking my phone to worship or something.
Yeah, I guess I don't mean to keep it.
But it's on.
You've just been on. I know
you've been on.
I'm going to, because I'm sorry I didn't get here. I got in a conversation and I just lost
track. Oh, I know.
I lost track.
In the pool hall. I heard about it.
You did?
Uh-huh.
I was in the pool hall after.
Oh.
When I got down there, I realized how late it was.
I'm just teasing you.
I know, but it was bad.
I'll come back and get to it. All right.